This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Stocks and bonds take a dive. Will Samsung survive September? And making sure Napa means Napa. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, September 9th. Thank you for joining us. On Fridays, we like to do a little recap of the big economic news of the week. So let's get to it. My weekly wrappers today are David Gura of Bloomberg and Catherine Rempel of The Washington Post. Thanks for the time, you two.
No problem. Hey, Molly.
Hey.
Hi there. So let's talk about markets today. That seems to be the big story. I saw that CNBC busted out the roaring bear graphic. David, what's going on? You having a busy day?
It was a busy day. We had a huge sell-off today, kind of on the heels of what Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, said yesterday. That was at this meeting that he was not keen to continue to do more easing. He was going to sort of wait, get a bit introspective, kind of mirroring what we're expecting from the Bank of Japan in a couple of weeks. They're going to sort of reevaluate what they've been doing as well. So on the heels of that, a massive sell-off in bonds first, and then stocks. We saw a sell-off that, like, which we haven't seen since the EU referendum in the UK back in June.
And Catherine, is that all because of this sort of ECB deciding to sit it out for now? Are there other factors at work here?
Yeah, I mean, there are other things going on, obviously, besides just that. You know, we've also seen China bond prices go up. You know, we've also seen, in terms of markets, we've seen some good news on the economy recently. We saw jobless claims go way down. They're basically about where they were, I think, in the 1970s. So, you know, the economy looks pretty good. And all of that suggests that the Fed itself as well may hold off on raising rates. So there's a lot of components going into this, I would say.
What else is there to say about bond yields? What does a flight from bonds mean for us specifically?
You know, I think there's a lot of confusion about what the Federal Reserve is going to do. Catherine said there are a lot of people who think that the Fed will not raise rates at its next meeting in September. They might wait till December or next year. And I'll say that the commentary we've gotten from Fed officials has been kind of confusing. The president of the Boston Fed today, who's been known to be pretty dovish, kind of moved into a more hawkish camp, saying, you know, maybe now is the time to go. John Williams of the San Francisco Fed kind of saying the same thing, that better to go sooner rather than later.
That's true. And Kansas City Fed president also said we're at full employment now. So
they're processing
mixed
all
signals.
Mixed signals and you know, economic data that is, I think, generally better, still kind of mixed in some regards. And obviously inflation is still a big concern. So I think that's kind of like what's been overarching here, sort of concern about what the Fed's going to do.
Now, Catherine and I, I'm going to do a complete pivot because Catherine and I, before the show, were talking about Apple, which is always relevant as one of the world's biggest companies, had a big announcement, taking a risk in the market that basically generates all of its revenue. So as long as I have you guys on the line, Catherine, what are you thinking about iPhone 7 and Apple's futures?
Well, I'm not super excited about it, but maybe I just don't have the same foresight and courage to use the term of the week, as Tim Cook, and based on feedback from techie friends and the Twitterverse at large, it seems like there's quite a bit of criticism of this new change with the headphones, that they'll be wireless, be easier to lose, they'll be more expensive, your dog's going to eat them, things like that. So I get the sense that there's not a lot of excitement about this product, at least relative to previous ones. And Apple, as you may know, even said that they're not going to release their pre-sale data, which is unusual for them. And
it is. It's a little sketchy, David. What do you think? There's been this sort of rumble that Apple could become like a value stock.
Yeah, you know, I was struck by Farhad Manjoo's column about how maybe Apple's no longer as focused on the aesthetics, the innovative aesthetics of its products as it used to be. It strikes me that this week's announcement seems above all else is good news for swimmers. Just the sort of waterproofing of the watch and the waterproofing
water resistance.
The water resistance of the watch and the iPhone as well. But I am one who upgrades when the battery is dead. So it tends to shake out once every 2 years, but I'm not one to rush out and get one, and I understand
where,
it's already a long
way to
November.
Where are you in that two-year cycle?
Five something.
On that embarrassing note, I'm going to call this to a close. David Gura and Catherine Rempel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Molly.
On Wall Street, much more on that steep sell-off. We will have all the details when we do the numbers. Oh, man, the news just keeps getting worse for Samsung. After last week's global recall of its flagship Galaxy Note 7 smartphone, today, U.S. safety regulators are telling owners of that phone to shut it down immediately and stop charging it because the phone's lithium-ion batteries can catch fire or explode. The Federal Aviation Administration doesn't want the phones on flights or in baggage. All of that wiped out about $10 billion of Samsung's value. And amidst all of that, along comes rival Apple with, as you heard, the big iPhone 7 launch. And industry analysts say the rivalry is not unrelated to Samsung's battery issues. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
Things had been going pretty well for Samsung.
You couldn't have asked for a worse time, right?
Analyst Will Stefega with IDC says Samsung had been gaining some ground against Apple. The Galaxy Note 7, with its note-taking features and iris scanner, began selling August 19th.
The device was very well received, and they were looking to shore up their position against the upcoming Apple iPhone 7 release.
Then batteries started exploding, and last week Samsung recalled all of the 2.5 million phones it had shipped. The estimated cost, as much as $1 billion. Pradeep Chintagunta is a professor of marketing at the University of Chicago. He says more stress testing would have revealed those problems before the launch.
Sometimes when you're in a hurry to launch these new products, you end up in a situation where you haven't perhaps tested the product as much as you should have.
But Neil Mostyn with Strategy Analytics in London doesn't expect device makers to heed this warning. The competition for more, better, faster is too fierce.
There are about 1,000 brands competing in the smartphone environment worldwide. So I think it's likely that the pace of delivery for new models is only going to get quicker, not slower.
If Samsung fixes its battery problem and makes customers whole, analysts say the company is likely to move past this fairly quickly. Meanwhile, it's got another headache, trying to recover nearly $40 million worth of TVs and appliances stranded at sea after the bankruptcy of Hanjin Shipping. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Location is everything in lots of parts of the economy, including winemaking. The terrain, the microclimates, and the soils all dictate the quality of wine grapes, and every great winemaking region wants to protect the prestige of its location, including California. See, a loophole in federal regulations lets any winemaker label its bottles with, say, Napa or Sonoma, as long as the grapes actually come from there. And as long as the resulting wine is only sold where the actual wine is made. So labels in Texas and Georgia are selling Napa wine, and California isn't having any of it. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more.
About 18 months ago, Rex Stultz with the trade group Napa Valley Vintners learned something he found worrisome.
A winemaker far from the state of California, somewhere in the south, was importing grapes from here and putting Napa Valley on the label of those wines. We didn't know that was permissible.
A loophole in federal regulations made it permissible. The Napa Valley vintners didn't like that.
We thought it was unfair that winemakers in prestigious wine regions in the United States, not just Napa Valley, are being exploited by those in other states.
With pressure from California lawmakers, federal regulators crafted a proposal to close the loophole. The proposal has some critics, among them Rob Wilson. He co-owns Times 10 Cellars, which has wineries in Dallas and Fort Worth, Texas. Wilson sometimes contracts with vineyards in places like Napa Valley.
We have one vineyard we work with in Napa Valley, and so we put the Napa Valley appellation on there. It's true to where the grapes come from.
It's unclear if growers who contract with wineries like Times 10 Cellars would be harmed by closing the wine labeling loophole. John Aguirre is president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers.
We've heard from growers who say, hey, these shipments of fresh wine grapes are very important to us, and our customers are going to be hurt.
But Aguirre says other growers don't want their brand diluted by out-of-state wineries. He's hoping they'll get more information on who all will be hurt by the rule change in the public comment period. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Calais, on the coast of northern France, has become a destination for thousands of migrants hoping to get into the UK. Many have stowed away on board lorries, we call them trucks, making the short trip through the tunnel under the English Channel. While they wait, these people live in a squalid camp called the Jungle. Aid workers there say they're running out of tents, food, and space. But the people keep coming, looking for any way they can to get into Britain. The BBC's Richard Galpin has this report from northern France.
Well, this is one of two big camps here in northern France for refugees and migrants. It's a cluster of wooden huts nestling between a motorway and a busy train line near Dunkirk. I was last here in March, and the atmosphere now is very different. There's a palpable sense of frustration amongst those living here, who are mostly Iraqi Kurds. They feel trapped. With security much tighter around the ports in Calais and Dunkirk and the Channel Tunnel, it's a lot harder to jump on the lorries heading to Britain. From the camp, we travelled more than 200 miles along the northern coast of France to the Cherbourg Peninsula. We'd heard some migrants had been moving along this coast, trying other less secure ports and harbours as jump-off points. We'd also heard that earlier this year, a group of migrants had been caught by the police getting onto a small motorboat in a popular tourist town not far from Cherbourg, perhaps in the hope of reaching Jersey. Several fishing boats were moored at the town's port, and the fishermen here said they were worried. Guillaume Blondel told me they were now locking up everything on their boats in case any migrants try to get on board. A few miles up the coast, near Cherbourg itself, we came across a makeshift migrant camp tucked away on some land behind a gym. Most of the people here were Afghan. Amir was despondent. The port at Cherbourg, he said, was not easier to get into than Calais. So having tried and failed to get into the port many times, I asked him if any smugglers had been offering places on small boats to get them out of France.
Because everyone knows a small boat is dangerous to go, but no one offers in Calais. I never heard this.
So you were never approached by one of the smugglers offering that?
No. If one person knows there is, small boats and someone will take you from there to England, everyone will know. But this thing, it never happened.
And that's a view shared by the local French authorities. They believe most refugees and migrants continue to try to get to England by jumping into lorries at the major ports or by paying thousands of pounds to smugglers to be hidden inside cars and given false documents. Frank Dersin, mayor of a small community near Dunkirk, says reports that thousands of refugees and migrants are preparing to board small boats this summer to reach Britain are nonsense.
It's completely false, and all those familiar with the difficulties of crossing the channel know the currents are very strong, the wind and storms are constant, the number of boats, the powerful currents, the sandbanks, make this almost impossible. And anyone organising this would have to buy boats in the shops here, and that people would find out about. And the police are extremely alert at the moment, with planes, helicopters and drones, which are constantly surveilling. So no, that's totally false. I can tell you that.
Des hélicoptères, des drones sont constamment en train de surveiller. Donc non, ça c'est totalement faux, je peux vous dire.
But the fact is, a few boats have crossed the channel in recent weeks. And the question remains whether this is a growing trend
or something which only a very few will try.
That's Richard Galpin from the BBC. Coming up,
taxes are a glimpse into a person's soul.
If you follow that logic, we have not seen Donald Trump's soul yet. But first, let's do the numbers. Not good, everyone. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 394 points. It closed at 18,085. The NASDAQ shaved off 133 points, 2.5%, to finish at 5,125. And the S&P 500 lost 53 points. That's 2.4%, ended the session at 2,127 for the week. And it was the second worst one of the year. The Dow erased 2.2%. The NASDAQ unloaded 2.4%. And the S&P also lost 2.4 points. As for the day, fears of a rate hike rattled just about everybody, including financial firms. Goldman Sachs reversed 1.8%. Morgan Stanley stepped back 1.4%. Samsung, by the way, down nearly 4% on its troubles. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. It is long-standing tradition, at least back to the 1970s, that if you are running for president in the United States, you will release your tax returns. We do this because, as Richard Nixon put it, people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. The Donald Trump campaign, however, has so far refused to release his tax returns. But let's ask the question, what would we actually learn if Trump were to hand over those returns? And yes, I know that's a really big if. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more.
The Trump International Hotel is the new name for what people here in D.C. still call the old post office. Contractors are working 7 days a week to fix up the grand 100-year-old building before it opens next week. And it is impressive, says passerby Charlie Sweet.
You know, we're looking right now at, the Trump townhouse, D.C.'s largest suite, 6,300 square feet. And where's the other sign they've got up now? The spa by Ivanka Trump. Very exciting.
This project is just one example of a fundamental paradox at the heart of Trump's campaign platform. Basically, that he's really, really rich and good at building things. But you'll just have to take his word for it because he's not releasing his tax returns.
Taxes are a glimpse into a person's soul, really.
Steve Rosenthal is a tax attorney and senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. One thing we do know, says Rosenthal, Trump's return is a massive document, chock full of details from over 500 separate LLCs and holding companies.
500 LLCs is extreme, even for billionaires. That's a large number of entities and a very complicated structure.
What we don't know are what's inside those companies. Things like how much debt he has, who he's borrowed from, how valuable his properties are. For instance, Trump regularly brags about how much his hotels and golf courses are worth, but when it comes to paying property taxes, it's another story. Case in point, the current battle over the Trump International Hotel, the city values it at $91 million. Trump says it's only worth $28. And then there's the sticky situation of income tax for real estate developers.
I would expect that his taxable income is zero.
Stuart Zimmerman is a former investment manager now working as an executive in residence at Washington University. Because of the way the tax code is written, developers are allowed to deduct millions of dollars for depreciation, even if their property is appreciating in value.
And if it ever gets to the point where it looks like there's going to be some taxable income and they're going to have to pay some tax because they're running out of depreciation, start another project. It'll show losses in those early first years.
Meaning the whole industry is basically one giant tax shelter, which, you know, isn't illegal, but it could make it hard for voters to relate. Matt Makowiak is a Republican strategist based in Texas. He says Trump's calculation to hold on to the returns probably isn't about politics as much as protecting Trump's carefully constructed image.
The single most important thing to Donald Trump is that he wants everyone, and particularly his peers, to believe that he's a billionaire. And so if the tax returns themselves showed him to not be as wealthy as he says he is, he could never accept that, ever.
Back at the Trump International Hotel, most of the people I spoke to are solidly in one camp or the other. Some, like Victor Perez, say they couldn't care less what Trump's net worth is, a topic he says reporters like me focus on way too much.
The question is this worth more than $1 billion? Yes or no?
I have no idea.
He's rich. It doesn't matter.
which may be exactly how Donald Trump would like us to feel. In Washington, D.C., I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
When you imagine someone sitting in a lifeguard chair at the beach, you probably think of a high school or college kid with a really great summer job. But summer's over, the beaches are still open, and saving lives in the water is actually a job that workers can hold well into their 60s. But as Sally Herships reports, in New York, the proud tradition of older lifeguards coming back year after year may be causing some problems.
Let's head to the beach. Long Island, to be exact. There's sand, kids playing, now add in some lifeguards. And let's be honest, there can be a stereotype here. Kind of a Baywatch tan orange bathing suit thing, and young. Our stereotype is probably young, but that is not the case at Jones Beach.
When I started in 67, nobody expected to work a lifetime here. I didn't.
A couple of weeks ago, I was swimming, and my plate fell out of my mouth and was going down. I had to dive for it. I got it. Most important thing, I rested all year.
What you're listening to is a documentary called The Jones Beach Boys, but some of the boys here wear dentures. Roy Lester is 66. He was a Jones Beach lifeguard for about 40 years. He's also a lawyer, and now he's suing. He's accusing the New York State Parks Department of age discrimination. The case is complicated, and it hinges on bathing suits, like one style called a jammer.
Jammers is like a biking short.
So it's like a lycra to your mid-thigh.
Yes.
Jammers are supposed to help swimmers go faster. How much exactly is in question.
It's just a feeling that you go through the water smoother.
So Lester says older lifeguards wore jammers when they took their annual swimming test. Then in 2007, the state banned the suits. Lester could have taken the test in an approved suit, but he refused, so he couldn't go back to his job. He says behind the ban was age discrimination.
Psychologically, when you're taking this rehire test, you look for every advantage. Because unlike anything else in the world, if you fail this test twice, you're done. Your career is done.
This is a lawsuit. There's argument about a lot of detail. And what makes the case even more complicated is that proving age discrimination can be difficult. The law says employers are allowed to set physical requirements for jobs, like swimming tests.
Isn't it good to try to make sure that you have fit lifeguards, you know, to be able to rescue people? And isn't that what you'd want the Parks Department to be doing?
Joseph Fishkin is a professor at Yale Law School.
So just by itself, saying you can wear swimsuit A, but you can't wear swimsuit B, that's not age discrimination.
Right. It's just, it depends what was the motivation behind it. What the law says you can't do is make sure your lifeguards are fit by getting rid of the older ones.
Chris Brewster is with the United States Life Saving Association. He says the lawsuit seems silly.
I am gobsmacked at the rationale behind this lawsuit, what Mr. Lester hopes to gain. It seems clear to me that he could have passed the test had he just worn the required shorts. And I'm sad for him that he threw away that opportunity.
Brewster says, contrary to the idea of Jones Beach trying to oust older workers, its union has been effective at representing them.
I think they probably have the oldest beach lifeguard corps in the United States. So if the administration has been trying to cull the number of older lifeguards, they've been pretty ineffective at it.
In 2005, the Parks Department issued a memo. It mentions the age of some lifeguards in their 60s and 70s. And it goes on to say this could raise serious safety issues for not only the public, but for the staff on duty. The Attorney General's office, which represents the Parks Department, had no comment. Roy Lester again.
You know, I gave them almost 40 years of my life. I was exemplary. I won national championships. I know lifeguarding. I can pass the test. Come on. Come on.
Now Lester is working at a private club. He says it's nice, but he'd like to be back at Jones Beach. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We'll be right back.
this final note before we go, Amazon, the company that sort of defined e-commerce, is moving more and more into the physical world. And now, says a Business Insider report, it's even going full mall kiosk. BI says the e-tailer will open up to 100 pop-up stores in various malls around the country by next year. The pop-ups will feature Amazon's own hardware like the Fire TV and the Amazon Echo, the Kindle e-readers, all of which do, as it happens, make it easier to shop online at Amazon. There's even a page hidden on Amazon's website devoted to its mall stores. And no, you can't get your ears pierced there. All right, that is it for us this week. Today, the Dow gave up 394 points. The NASDAQ shaved off 133. The S&P 500 lost 53 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Speaking of music, wasn't it good this week? That's Daisy Palacios. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves, the executive producer. Deborah Clark, the vice president. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.